kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 61, with me, Doug Belshaw.
And me, Doug Barnes. Hey, Doug, how are you getting on?
I'm good, thank you. I've just been browsing the iTunes EdTech podcast library. I don't know if you've seen this. It kind of has the most popular podcasts in a particular directory. So this drills down from podcast to education to educational technology. And guess what? We're in there.
Are we really?
Mm.
Well, there you go, you see. You can't argue with quality, can you?
I have to say there's possibly about 200 podcasts there.
200? All right, we're one of 200. Well, that's better than being none of 200, maybe.
Yeah, and some of them are a bit weird. Like there's Women in Antarctica.
Nice. Okay, there's one called School Sucks. I guess that might be something to do with it.
Yeah, there's some very bizarre things in here. Like there's one called, where is it? Sex Advice from Oprah.
Excellent. There's one called World Ocean Radio.
So we're in good company, is I guess what I'm saying.
So there's some good stuff. A-level ICT revision, CS book club.
There's one called The Enormous Crocodile.
Excellent.
Apparently 70% of podcasts are listened to through iTunes.
70%? Well, that shows you Apple's dominance in a market here, particularly the English-speaking market, possibly.
Which is bizarre, given the, you know, maybe podcasts are, a privileged middle-class thing to do.
I think that's not necessarily true. Maybe, maybe not. I think it's possibly something to do with technology is a privileged middle-class thing. And if you look at technology rising possibly as a volcano, sort of, you know, tapering to the top, as it were, then as the tech and podcasts will come their way and pass their way around the world to the 4 billion internet users that exist already, and the more that will come. But there's one podcast on here called Beef Management, which I
I'm hitting the subscribe button right now.
Hot topic in ed tech, I hear. So maybe the algorithms within iTunes software are not quite what they appear.
Well, at least we're kind of not in that list. Because can you imagine if we weren't in that list?
I know, that'd be dreadful. If I wasn't,
would that alongside, actually say about this podcast?
That's it. If I wasn't alongside Beef Management, I don't know what I'd do.
Anyway, talking of the kind of meta level things about the podcast. People listening to this might be interested to know that if they go to tidepodcast.org, no longer will they be presented with a Tumblr blog.
No. Why?
Well, you know, I'm all for self-hosting, as are you. You know, you and I both use Reclaim Hosting to host our domains and stuff, don't we?
We do.
So we had a discussion, and I decided on Podcast Generator, which is an open source podcast publishing solution, and it's been around for about 10 years. And I have to say, it couldn't be easier to use. So anyone who's interested in doing their own podcast, basically you download a zip file, you upload that zip file into the folder of your choice on your website, and you unzip it, and then you access the website, and you follow the three-step setup, and it configures everything, including submitting your podcast to iTunes, which of course we didn't need to do because we've already done that before. But if you go there now, if you go to tidepodcast.org, it all looks very clean and clear. There's only episode 60 on there at the moment, because I'm going to add the kind of back episodes in as we go, but you can very quickly and easily see how to get stuff either on the website. There's a built-in embed of the podcast where you can just click play, and there's links to SoundCloud, iTunes and Internet Archive.
So you've used Podcast Generator to deal with the audio, is that right? Or is it not to build the website itself?
Yes, that's right. So Podcast Generator generates the website, but it also does all of the XML and the metadata and everything as well.
Okay. So tell me, does it put it up onto SoundCloud and Internet Archive?
No, right. So let's say that you were starting a podcast from scratch. You'd probably just literally upload your, through the interface, through the web interface, you'd upload the audio that you created and you'd just use it from here and it would submit it to iTunes. We actually do it a bit more of a complicated way. So we upload the audio to SoundCloud, which generates the RSS feed, which puts into iTunes. But if you started from scratch with a podcast, this would be the easiest thing to do.
Sounds good. And you wouldn't need a SoundCloud subscription.
Well, you wouldn't. But the good thing about SoundCloud is discovery. And also, if you link to a SoundCloud file, you can play it embedded within a tweet. So...
That's true, you can. SoundCloud are pretty good at their embedding on.
So we're in multiple places. We're on our own website. SoundCloud feeds into iTunes and then other podcast clients. And then we've got the backup of the backup in the Internet Archive.
Yes.
So, excellent. Well, basically, people will be able to hear our dulcet tones until the heat death of the universe.
This is superb. It's like a belt and braces approach, which brings me to something I've done for the first time this week. So this
warm braces.
That's correct.
Really?
Yes. So I've worn braces the odd time before, but always with a belt kind of thing. But now I've lost weight over the summer, so my trousers don't quite fit.
Right.
And so I've taken to wearing a braces to like a suspension system rather than a belt, and it's really cool.
I have to say, no school I've ever taught in would I get away with wearing braces.
Well, people can't see them because I wear a waistcoat.
Oh, so, of course.
So that's
have you, what about your cummerbund? Is that firmly in place? Or?
No, I don't wear a cummerbund. I always think they're there to hide things, and I've got nothing to hide.
Right.
Oh. Okay, anyway, back to a more serious note. What have you been up to this week?
So it's Tuesday night, which is the regular time we're recording this. I think it's going out every Friday. So today I've had a follow-up meeting with representatives from Sunderland Council about a potential digital passport for the city. So I had a meeting there. I've taken it a bit easier yesterday and today, doing bits and pieces of work, writing things up around the Creative Commons Thinkathon we did last week and the London CLC one we did through the cooperative. Had lunch with a previous colleague, Andy Stewart from JISC.
Oh, I remember Andy.
I also visited, although I didn't actually get a chance to mess about with it. I visited a VR studio. It's kind of the one of the main ones. Like Oculus are based there. It's in Gateshead. There's a little cluster of VR companies, and I know a guy there. So I was just catching up with him and what he's up to. He's doing like VR for Northumbrian Water. Which is bizarre.
No. Explain that. What VR do Northumbrian Water need?
Well, they're doing like a gamification platform, but they want... I mean, if you imagine that you get your bill in cubic meters, which is a bit of an abstract concept, so you'll be able to do like augmented reality kind of stuff with your bill, so the kids in particular can see what a cubic meter of water looks like in their environment.
Oh my gosh, that's insane.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
So it was that. I did some Critical Friend work. I met up about MozFest, and we're doing three sessions there. I met up with a guy who's developed a new kind of CMS or LMS called Lucas Blair, who does stuff around gamification. Guy from Concentric Sky about a new API and standard for open badges called Open Pathways, which is going to be interesting. Okay. Oh, I've talked to so many people in the last week, seriously. I couldn't list them all. So just kind of doing that business development. And then tomorrow, I suppose we'll get to this at the end, but I'm off to Jersey, and I'll talk about that at the end.
Fab, okay.
When
we recorded last week, the next morning I was going to do some Lower Six digital induction sessions, 55-minute sessions. And so I did three of those, the same session over and over again. So the first one, it was the first one in the morning, and the audience were very quiet. So it was about 70 pupils in each. And they didn't really, so there were a couple of my pupils in there whom I know very well, and they were smiling and, giggling a little bit in the right places. So we did like some live Google Docs editing in front of them. But the school's just had this massive sort of, like 5x3 meter screen put up in the Great Hall, we call it. This is a very old hall because the school's very old, which is all, many panels kind of thing. So it's all very flashy. So I was standing at this podium, and I think it was on the third of these presentations. Unfortunately, I had this message appear on the screen in front of me on the lectern, and it said shut down, yes or no, and I couldn't press anything, and there were no buttons, and the cupboard under lectern was all locked, so I had no access to the computer whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I was talking to the children about this happening, and then turned around and realized it wasn't on the big screen, it was just on my screen. So I took a picture of it and showed them that I wasn't insane. And then about 5 minutes later or 10 minutes later or whatever, after the expiry time on this message, it shut the monitor down. So I couldn't see what I was doing, so I had to take this lectern and spin it around so I could. It all just got a little bit bonkers and out of hand. Anyway, the audience has warmed up. So the second audience was quite good, and the third audience was were in the aisles laughing. It was all good.
So
that was quite fun. It was nice to sort of meet them all, and they can put a face to my name, as it were, because with so many, with the school being the nature it is, we don't have assembly, for example, with the whole school in one place.
How big is your school? I've forgotten.
It's 1,100 pupils.
Right. Okay.
But there are so many teachers, that's why you don't see so many of them, if you see what I mean. And anyway, so that was good. Did that. I've been doing PSHE on digital stuff, like online profiles with the lower six, like little sessions. So I did one of those last night, which went very well. And I forgot to talk about sexting, though, which was a problem because we needed to do that. But it was good sort of getting them to. So I went live in my Facebook profile in front of them. I went live into their Facebook profiles, and we checked out what they looked like. And a couple of them were my tutees last year in my former boarding house. And so I know them very well, and it was all fine. I knew one of them had some dodgy stuff in there. But it was, so some stuff with swear words, but it was connected to Paris and not killing people anymore and things like that. But it was just look, you know, getting them to think about, their university application coming in 12 months time, and the universities are going to find out who they are, and they're probably going to employ a company to find out who they are rather than just do it themselves, if you see what I mean, as part of the
a bit of a random connection here, but I was in the gym the other day, and you know, the time that I go to the gym, the wonderful thing about, you know, being self-employed is I can structure my day however I want. So often I go to the gym after dropping my daughter off at school, and sure enough, there's either Jeremy Kyle or Lorraine on TV, and the sound's off, and it's all subtitles. Well, I'm there on the exercise bike, you know, my fat crying, sweating away, and they've got some very stiff-looking former police officers who are now, you know, former detectives who go around scaring people about e-safety, and this was how they were trying to see how many children they could catch. By like within a certain amount of time in a chat room, but
okay,
and they weren't allowed to actually catch them in inverted commas, because that would actually be breaking the law. But what they were trying to do was get them to give away their location and all that kind of stuff. And they reckoned they could groom a child within 20 seconds. But I'm just sitting there trying not to laugh, because the whole concept was ridiculous.
I found that as well. So one of the videos, this PSHE session I did, was planned by somebody else. And one of the videos was a guy called, is it Jim Vale or something, who's some kind of YouTuber, just American. And he's going around, like, talking to people on the beach about the stuff that they put on their Instagram or whatever. But obviously he doesn't tell them that. And he's just saying, do you have a dog called, or saying, hi, Jerry, we went to university together. Do you remember we were in that sort of medical class, or, you know, some class, we're in some class together. Do you remember? And all of that kind of thing. And essentially a couple of them fell for it, but mostly people were just like scratching their heads and, you know, telling him where to go. It's quite funny. So I thought about this, and I thought, well, I know exactly what I put on my social media outlets, you know, and I would remember if someone was talking to me, well, you've seen that there, because how else would you know that? You just eliminate the impossible, and what's left is the truth. So I was, it's a similar sort of thing. It was all just like spurious nonsense.
And I see all this kind of stuff. I mean, what we're going to talk about today is kind of the many facets of open, especially to do with open education. And to me, all of this stuff serves as a, almost like a folk warnings about don't be too open, otherwise your children might be at risk, or like don't be, you know, telling stories about some child being murdered somewhere, therefore you should lock down everything your kid ever does online and everything like that. Like, it just seems wrong.
It seems wrong, doesn't it? Because it's not actually teaching anyone to do anything, or no one's learning how to do anything rather than being taught. And that's the problem with it, isn't it? So if you work in an open way, people learn how to behave in an open way. It doesn't get them into trouble, which is kind of what you really want, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weird. But yeah, shall we dive into it? Okay, so the many facets of open. There's a few. There's three posts by me here, one by Audrey Waters and one by Jim Groom. We did consider, just for those listening, a couple of posts by Stephen Downs and Mike Caulfield, who you might see linked to from these posts. The reason why we haven't included them is because we felt that they were going off at a different tangent, which is fascinating, but not really within the scope of what we want to talk about here. For those interested, Stephen Downs and Mike Caulfield were talking about whether institutions are the guardians of culture, and it kind of more broadly speaking, which is fascinating, but not really focused on what we mean by openness here. And so we'll just focus on what I've written and Audrey and Jim. So I'll start off by putting you on the spot, Di, if you don't mind. You know, when people talk to you about like openness and open education, what kind of springs to mind to you? And do you consider yourself to be an open educator?
Okay, that's an interesting question. Yes and no is the answer. So I would consider myself to work in an open way. Mm-hmm. But mostly I don't share a lot of like things that I do online. So I'll share things that I think are worthwhile, or things that, you know, that I've put together in different ways or whatever. And that is a tangible object, if you like, or a virtual object, and can be shared. But most of the stuff, the way that I teach is not like that. It's kind of very much, I don't teach via planned scheme of work with, we do this link, these links, that lesson, these links, that lesson, these links, that lesson, this activity, this activity, this activity. It's not how I work. I kind of, work them all out from week to week to week. And the next time I do it, I do the same thing. And if the thing was good enough to be remembered, then I use it again. But if I don't remember it, I don't use it, if you see what I mean.
Do you feel, for those who don't know, we used to do a podcast, almost 10 years ago, about 2007 to about 2010, yeah. We did a podcast called EdTech Roundup. And we were both, I mean, you're director of digital strategy now. I'm a consultant. So I've worked for Mozilla, etc. We were both regular classroom teachers at that point. Do you feel like you're more or less open than then?
Back then, I kind of put a pressure on myself to share more things that I was doing in the classroom. But I would say that so for me, the word open means an approach to how I do my work. Which gives me motivation to make sure that decision-making processes are clear to others, and that others are free to use whatever I do, should they choose to. But often there's two types of open in my life, I guess. One is being open within my workplace. One is being open within the world. And so I am quite open within the world, I think, but I don't really share a lot of stuff because I don't assemble a lot of articles or objects that could be useful to other people.
Something that I haven't explicitly written about yet, but it's there at the back of my mind, is the difference between what I would call openness, which is what you just described there as being open to the world, and kind of transparency, which is what I would consider to be the openness within the organization, like transparent ways of working within your organization. Well, sometimes you can't open that up to the world.
Yes, I think that's right. But I don't, even within an organization, I don't really subscribe to the idea of transparency. So I think there's a necessary, sometimes it is necessary not to be transparent. But still, I would hope that the processes that cannot be transparent are still dealt with openly. Does that make sense?
No, that does make sense. I guess my last question before we dive into these particular articles, and again, sorry for putting you on the spot, but I'm just genuinely interested. So would you, if someone used the term open educator, would you see that as being something on the spectrum of like positive or negative, or is it just a way of describing something just like something's blue or green or yellow?
I'd see being an open educator as being a very positive thing in my mind.
Right, cool. Good. A few months back, I wrote just a quick post. I mean, I can't draw for toffee. I've said before how I wasn't allowed to do GCSE art because I wouldn't have got a C. But I just tried to sketch out with a very simple diagram next to each different types of open. And I just tweeted this out and said, what other kinds of open are there? And I just put in, there's open as in door, you're free to enter. Open as in for business, you're invited to buy or sell or trade. There's open as in unlocked, you have access to a thing that other people potentially do not. And open as in to ideas, you're willing to have your mind changed. I don't know if you remember this, Di, but other people chipped in. I don't know if you did. Some people kind of...
I do remember this completely. Mm. And because it's in the next post, is it? So that's just a quick diagram of thought, really.
Mm.
There, but you have more meanings of open. Oh, no, we were on another diagram of thought.
Yes, it is. Yes, so it's got transparency, platform or space, open mm-hmm. to amendments or hacks, open as in warmth or love or humanity, open as in exploring, open as in open-ended, open as in opened up, open as in flexible and adaptable, and open as in no barriers. So I found that really interesting, and I kept meaning to do something with it. I was going to actually write something for DML Central, but you know when you just can't find the right angle? It's a bit like when you're teaching, like you can't find the right angle to get into something that you want to teach. It's the same kind of thing here. I couldn't find the right angle for what it is I wanted to say.
It's difficult. I think it's more than one thing that you need to say, as it were. But carry on.
Well, it was particularly pertinent because we are open, the cooperative I'm part of. You know, people... They don't explicitly say what do you mean by openness, because that would seem like a ridiculous question. But there's certainly some puzzlement's a bit strong, but certainly some ambiguity around what kind of openness do you mean. And I think sometimes that's a productive ambiguity, and sometimes it can lead to confusion. So I just wanted to explore some of that.
Okay.
So I started to write this blog post, and I don't always write blog post straight off, you know, a bit like, I can remember, you know, you wrote that several thousand word piece after you were in Crete, and I guess you didn't write that straight off, probably in spurts and sections.
No, to be honest, I wrote and I drank and I published. to be open about it.
No, good. So last week I started writing it, Monday, Tuesday, and I got to a point where I was like, oh, I'm not too sure what to write about this. I'd quoted Audrey, which we'll talk about in a moment, Audrey Waters. But then Jim Groom, the next day after I was a bit stuck, wasn't sure what to write, Jim Groom wrote a blog post called The Overselling of Open, which meant that I could finish my blog post, which has the same title as Audrey's, which is What Do We Mean by Open Education? So, shall we start with Audrey's?
Yes, let's do that.
So, I don't know if you had a chance to read all these, Di. Audrey talks about a blog post by Martin Weller back in 2013. Her article was written at the end of 2015, I think it was. And she's got a slightly different angle. But her key point, and it's hard not to argue with this, she says about halfway down, Here's a key question. Does open actually transform the way in which we do school, the way in which we teach and learn? And so she's almost critiquing open as a useful term. She goes on to talk about some of the metaphors from before, like open for business, open-ended intellectual exploration. And she says, quote, open education needs to be about more than adopting products that have open on the label. It means building on the affordances of open licenses, but it means examining more broadly which elements of our beliefs and practices around teaching and learning are open or closed, and who the gatekeepers in deciding what that looks like. So basically, the last paragraph, I'll just quote that as well, because it's useful. We can't simply let one adjective, open, be the substitute for the hard work, the political work even, of rethinking what learning can look like. End of quote.
So that's really interesting. So let me address what's going on in my head.
Mm.
I'll put that out there. So for me, being an open educator, if I dare assume that label, is a lot to do with what I do in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot to do with making sure that the web is open in my classroom, making sure that the processes that I set into motion in my classroom are open, which to me means up for redefinition or up for a bit of manipulation or pushing one way or the other, as in response to the pupils that I'm working with. I hope that my classroom feels like a very open place where people can take risks, can make suggestions, can challenge me in a without ever feeling like they're really challenging me, and can push back on things, you know, and that the course of what's going on in the room can change according to those that are in the room. Is that fair to say?
I think so, yeah. I mean, one way that what you just described, it reminds me of a post I read earlier this week on a blog called The Conversation, which is, I think it's an Australian blog, I'm not sure. It certainly said that it was, this particular blog post was part of a wider series called Big Issues in Australian Education.
Uh-huh.
And it was talking about learning styles, which seems to be like, you know, something that just doesn't die. Now, my thing about learning styles is that it has both primary and secondary effects. So if you said, do learning styles exist? Are they fixed in students' minds for all time? Obviously not, no, that's ridiculous. But does introducing the concept of learning styles to people who were previously only taught in one way lead to useful secondary effects? Absolutely, because it makes people think about the different ways in which something could be learned. It's almost like a heuristic. It's almost the very definition of a heuristic in the sense that you're leading people into a situation where they can learn something for themselves. So that's what, for me, that's what openness is like. The fact that it is a bit undefined and it has many different ways of thinking about very different metaphors, it's almost like a series of lenses in which you can view education and your own practice. That makes sense?
It does.
So I really like Audrey's post, and I thought that it was an interesting way of getting at it. Obviously, everyone's coming at this from a different point of view, like I've just said. So the next one, which allowed me to kind of finish the blog post that I wrote, was The Overselling of Open by Jim Groom. For those who don't know Jim, and I can't imagine that would be many people, Jim used to work at the University of Mary Washington, created a course called DS106, Digital Storytelling, opened that out, literally opened it out to the internet, and 6 years later, that course is still going with its students becoming teachers, interacting with each other, setting up a radio station. Basically, it's a course that never ends, and people have set up their own versions of this, etc. Jim then did the Domain of One's Own project, which we'll probably talk about a lot more over coming weeks, and founded Reclaim Hosting off the back of that. Decamped, moved to Italy with his Italian wife, he's American, and now runs Reclaim Hosting, which we just mentioned before. And, you know, they solved the problem I had with the Tide podcast website, you know, instantly. They're great. But Jim talks about all kinds of things, both from the technology end and the pedagogical end. And in this particular post, I don't know what you thought about Di, but he talks about a couple of presentations that he's done. He mentions Martin Weller as well. And the thing that he talks about is that he's almost, where's the bit? He says he's almost kind of done with open education. So let me just quote this.
So it says 2004 to 2011 somewhere, doesn't he?
Here it is. He says, I'm quite ambivalent about the open movement more generally these days. What seemed like a movement defined by an anarchic spirit of revolution from 2004 to 2011, brackets at least for me, this was a fairly personal narrative, in the brackets, morphed into a fairly tame, almost conservative approach to education, massive lectures and free textbooks. I'm oversimplifying here, of course, but at the same time, the mad scramble around corporate-sponsored MOOCs for elite universities from 2012 until about now, coupled with a rebranding of OER, at least in the US, as predominantly a cost-saving measure, left me fairly depressed. This was not all of EdTech, for sure, but it certainly has demanded much of the time, energy, and resources of the field for years now. And I must admit, I remain somewhat bitter about the funneling of massive resources almost exclusively into these two approaches, though I'm sure that has been part of a significant part of their own struggle. End of quote.
Yeah, I think so. For me, this sort of touched me most personally in my approach to open, I think, from in the post more than Audrey's post, if you see what I mean. And even though he mirrors what Audrey's saying effectively about, you know, just calling something OER doesn't make it anything different to what it was before you did, kind of thing. And it's the word just gets adopted. You talk about this well in your post, I think. The word just gets adopted and taken to because people think it's going to make them some cash, basically. and we have to be really, really careful about that. And I'd possibly argue here one of our old sort of tangents, really, of scale, and that this is what these companies are trying to do, is bring scale to the idea of being open. And it's possible that those that have adopted the word open as part of their identity and how they work are being small, allowing things to be big, should people wish it to be. You know, should people take it on board and sort of adapt it, remix it for themselves, and rather than these big corporations coming in and just trying to find any word that they can stuff into their headlines that makes people buy their stuff, makes them believe.
I think that is done in a cynical way by some people. I certainly wouldn't argue against that. But I think it's also done by people, and I hope I wouldn't be counted by other people as one of these, by people who maybe used to work in formal education, have gone to work for a vendor or a for-profit company or whatever, and try to maintain an identity that they legitimately had within a particular domain, and try and like say, hey, I'm still the same guy, but now in a for-profit situation. And so are taking a term and using it in a different situation and actually really abusing that term. And I think that's where not the like the big open washing, as people call it, of you know, like the likes of Pearson and Blackboard, but the kind of smaller scale stuff where people are just trying to milk whatever good feeling they had in their network for all that it's worth, even though they've changed positions and are just salespeople.
No, I think that's a fair point. It's possibly a bit it's difficult, isn't it, because you know we need corporations to make the world turn around, kind of thing.
We need organizations. We don't necessarily need for-profit organizations.
That's true. And I think if I was running an organization now, I'd maybe, for profit or not, you want your organization to be successful. And I mean, I tell you what I'm reminded of, right? Once upon a time, my dad, I don't know if I've mentioned this before on Ty, tell me if I have. My dad was on the Money Program, which is used to be a Sunday night TV show at 7 o'clock on a Sunday, which was very dull about financial world. But he was a bank manager, and because he was corporate regional manager for Midland Bank, now HSBC, in Hull, in Humberside, in the sort of north, large north area. So Hull is the most resistant city to recession in the country, for some reason, because it sits at the end of the M62. It doesn't have a link up from London, I guess, something to do with that. And so they came to interview him about it. And one of the things that I'll always remember that he said in his interview was that he said, yes, I think we will see a return to prudent banking. Now, this is back in the 1980s. And he's been retired for 22 years now. And so it's a long time ago. And if someone of my father's caliber and integrity were in charge of banking, then the banking crisis that we have seen over the last 10 years would not have happened, sort of thing, because he was, you know, working in in a conservative methodology. That's, you know, that's what he saw. You know, things were called things for a reason, and they stayed that way for a reason. You know, and he was always a sort of fan of, like, there are some people in the world, some people in the world change the world, and some people make it go round. And he was one that made it go round, as far as he saw it. And that was his philosophy. I'm not subscribing to it necessarily. And but this idea, you know, once upon a time, people looked after things and did things with integrity and a sort of a moral compass, or well-guided moral compass, should we say. And I get the feeling in my middle age, I guess, that that moral compass is somewhat missing from a lot of what goes on.
I don't buy into that there used to be a golden age philosophy at all.
I had this conversation
with my grandmother before. She said, oh, during the war, we all left our doors open and everything was fine. And yeah, but also there was a lot of petty thievery and larceny that went on during the Second World War.
Absolutely.
You know, and she tells me about the time when they got black market petrol so they could go over. Like, there wasn't a moral compass. The human condition is the human condition. Like, this, we are the way that we are.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I'm not saying that there was a golden era and that banking was all great back then. What I'm saying is that the way that my father operated, which to me as a young man or a child, felt like that's what a lot of the world was. There doesn't seem to be much of that around anymore. You know, someone will go and adopt the word open into their course so that they will make some cash. They don't give a hoot of whether they're being actually open or not. It's irrelevant. So meaning is irrelevant, you know.
Right. I think part of that is because the economy rules all these days, and everything is mediated by the market. I was reminded, actually, I was almost bought on my Kindle this morning, but I've got a copy of it right here, so I didn't feel like I wanted to spend any more money on it. But if anyone who's listening hasn't read Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle, it's a bit hard going at the start because it's, you know, what, 1960s French post-structuralist philosophy or situationist philosophy. But it's almost like in aphorisms towards the end. And some of the stuff that he's talking about in the 1960s, I haven't got a quote to hand, but almost predicting the way in which we can't talk to each other properly because everything's mediated by the economy and the market and, you know, trying to make money. In the same way that, you know, recently I've been trying to think about the difference between having a side project, i.e. something that makes money, versus having a hobby, and how having a hobby is almost looked down upon these days. Anyway,
true,
massive tangent.
Yeah, no, it was. But it is something, I mean, for me, there is something in this. At some point, somewhere in these companies, it comes down to the individuals who are making decisions. It comes down to their character, whether someone turns around or not. So the head at my school, for example, we're in a meeting of 40 people or whatever, and someone suggested that we looked at the idea of doing something that manipulated our UCAS applications. Because university is being very generous at the moment, so they're taking children when they hit like one or two grades under their conditional offer, and we exploited that. And she just simply said that would be immoral. We are not going to do that. And that was a nice thing, you know. It was nice to have that kind of feeling, especially from somebody in her particular leadership role, because that's what I'm talking about. You need a little bit more of that integrity in organizations, it's just the market, the economy that's actually taking that away from us, you know.
Sometimes it literally is people either being lazy and haven't done the research and therefore don't know what it means, or their previous experience thinking they know what it means, or using the wrong metaphor or whatever. I mean, we talked before about the example that Elan Ezekiel gave about someone saying that they do agile, but what they meant was hot desking. Like, people do sometimes literally get the wrong end of the stick.
Or purposefully allow a definition to be assumed that doesn't really exist, you know, because they're not sort of scrutinizing enough. And they might genuinely be making a mistake, true, too. It's not necessarily always cynical nonsense. That's a fair play.
And also, like, we shouldn't be too precious about It's not the word that we're bothered about. It's the ethos. And so we shouldn't. Sometimes we should be looking for new words. We should possibly abandon a term because it's become useless. I mean, what Richard Rorty would call it, a dead metaphor. Actually, I include this. I've got a blog called Ambiguities, Dar, which I think you've seen. And almost in every blog post, I include that spectrum, that continuum of ambiguity. And to me, it's one of my ways of thinking about the world. And some terms do end up becoming dead metaphors. They do no useful work. They're almost a shorthand for nothing. Like, they don't mean anything anymore. And if we get to that situation, then we need to possibly not try and rescue it, but come up with a new term. Like, maybe that's what we need to do.
Well, I think that's it. But also, I mean, one of the problems with it is what we're doing now, actually, is we're sitting here talking, and instead of talking about what it means to be open, we're talking about events that have happened that are making us define what is not open. You know, stop stealing open, stop stealing it because it doesn't mean this thing. But maybe we should talk a little bit more about what does it mean to be open?
Well, the diagram which I've included in this blog post, so onto my blog post, which are same as Audrey's, what do we mean by open education? Mm-hmm. So I quote both Audrey and Jim. I mentioned all of the metaphors that we talked about at the start, like being open for business and open door and open space and stuff. Talk about the continuum of ambiguity. But then what I've included is a really nice diagram that Helen Beetham and Rona Sharp used when they were doing some work for JISC back in 2009.
I've read some Beetham before.
Mm. She's great. Like, she doesn't suffer fools gladly at all. And
I remember her. I can't remember what the hell I wrote, what I read, but I remember I have her name in a positive light in my mind.
Mm. She's great. I worked with her a bit at JISC. She's a consultant for JISC and stuff. And Rona Sharp's at Oxford Brookes, I think. I'm not sure. Anyway, so this particular diagram, and if you people listening, if you click through, it's a triangle. And they're talking. This is ostensibly about digital literacies and digital skills. And they're talking at the bottom about the bottom rung of this pyramid is kind of digital access. And the way that they think about this is
okay. I'm going to do this for radio. Okay, so we have a triangle in front of us. It has four layers to it. The bottom layer is access. The next layer is skills. The next layer is practices. The next layer is attributes. And it has a kind of a verb connected to each of those. So access is I have, skills is I can, practices is I do, and attributes at the top is I am. Okay, continue, Jeff.
Good skills, right. So if you imagine at the bottom of that, access would be the stuff that, I mean, this it's interesting how much this has died down. You know, talk about the digital divide. You just don't hear as much about that in the press and in the stuff that's in the blogosphere, etc. So it's almost assumed that people have a reasonably fast connection to the internet and that access isn't really a problem. So we're not really at that level in terms of digital access. One thing you might apply to, which is what we've just talked about, is open educational resources. So sometimes you have access to the internet, but you don't have access to, for example, the journal article or the textbook or whatever it is, because it's not opened up. So there's a level of access. But then what I feel like we're not doing within the open education community is like consciously moving up that pyramid. Yes, there's some work around open educational practices, but we're certainly not at the realm of identity. We're not at the realm of this is what it means to be an open educator. And I feel like if we define that a bit better, if open is the term we want to use, we might find a different term. This thing that we're talking about all the things you mentioned about there, about the way that you approach your classroom, open to new ideas, sharing with other people, etc. If that's what it means to be open educator, then we need something more about identity. Some people might say, well, I get my identity through sharing with the DS106 community, etc. But I feel like there's too much of a high barrier to getting involved in this. One of the things that I didn't link to because I felt like it was a bit too much of a rabbit hole for people reading this was a guy, I think he's based in Germany, who gets asked a lot, like people who are new to open education saying, oh, hey, so what shall I read? And his problem was, well, what do you read? Where are the canonical foundational texts here? where are people explaining how they're an open educator, etc. And you know, I'm in the same kind of I'm pointing my finger back at myself here. Like, how do you show that you're an open educator? Where are the things you need to read? In every other kind of school of thought or approach, there would be those things that everyone points to. So there's a real problem there, as far as I can see. And I included a meme at the end of it, which is that guy from the US presidential race saying, the barrier, oh no, it's from a rent hike thing, wasn't it? The barrier to being an open educator is too damn high. That's what it feels like. Like, how do you even get started with this stuff?
I think it's quite interesting. I mean, I don't know. So I've never really gone in for the sort of open educational resources, the OER thing. I've never really done that. I've always thought it was something that was operating at a higher level than me. And it's a difficult, I guess it is a difficult thing to sort of penetrate. And whereas I talk a lot about being open or in the ways that I've described earlier in the podcast, I've talked about that to people and I'll talk about it wherever I go, but I've never written about it, never sort of made a claim for it to my name, as it were. I'm Dai Barnes, I'm an open educator. I don't know.
I guess this is what I feel like we should be doing.
Should I be writing that? Should I be sharing with the world? So I kind of do it by doing it, but I don't do it. Do you know what I mean? So I share stuff all of the time, but maybe people don't perceive that as being open or don't really understand what it is that I'm doing.
Well, I feel like we could... I certainly don't want to be prescriptive, but I feel like we could get towards more of a world that we want by doing that kind of thing. Just a note on open educational resources. So when I did work at JISC, I was part of the Open Educational Resources Program. And I can't remember who it was, but someone said that OER is a supply-side concept, yeah? There's no one really pulling, saying, oh, if only I had an open educational resource, my lessons would be so much better. It's making sure the supply is okay, so that you don't think, you know, my wife when she's planning a lesson, whatever, doesn't think, oh, I know, I'll go and look in an OER repository. Like, you just search for the thing, and it happens to be Creative Commons licensed or public domain or whatever, and you think, great, I can use it. I can share what I've changed about it. What's missing about that whole landscape, and we're more than a decade in, is, and I'm going to use a GitHub analogy. So GitHub, for those who are listening or don't know, is a way in which you store code and you can fork repositories. You can create a copy of it and then make your own version of the thing that happened before, and people can see how you've done that, etc. That is what we need with open educational resources, so that people can build off each other's work without having to like tipex off copyright things before they photocopy it, and you know, not sure whether they're allowed to use this, therefore having to close down access to it within their VLE and stuff like that. What we need is taking OER for granted and then moving up that pyramid.
Interesting idea, isn't it? So, and Creative Commons is an interesting sort of a bedfellow, really, of being open, isn't it? You know, that it suggests a way of marking your resources to be used for money. And sorry, can you hear that noise in the background?
Yes, I can.
Okay, that's the pupils just coming out of their homework time. And having some fun, it sounds.
9 p.m., wow.
So Creative Commons, I think, creates a nice sort of bedfellow, as I say, this sort of parallel in the idea of sharing things openly out there on the web that other people can use. I'm just struck by something. A conversation I had recently with somebody whom I won't mention the name was talking about the TES resources. So, you know, there's loads of it's much more so than when you were in teaching. The TES resources now are immense. There's lots and lots and lots
of people get paid for it, yeah?
Yeah, they get paid for it enormously. And in America, so the highest paid educator, I believe, in the world is living in America, and they earn something like $3 million a year or something daft. And the reason is because there's a mechanism in America by which you can make stuff and you sell it. So every time people use it, it is pushed to the top and people are paying for this stuff. And
this is teachers pay teachers, isn't it?
That's right, yes, that's what it's called. And so that, what that model does is, because people are paying for it, they won't pay for it unless it's worthwhile. Therefore, it pushes the best stuff up to the top by its very nature. And
best is a interesting concept, isn't it?
Well, it is complicated and worth unpacking, but yeah. If we just sort of...
But yeah, I know what you mean. Like, it's like the Amazon rating system. Yeah, good.
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely. And it was just an interesting idea. And professional development in America is very different. So teachers pay for their own. They don't... the schools don't pay for it. And so this sort of thing is paid for by teachers. So that's why it's called teachers pay teachers kind of thing.
Mm.
And
I don't think it's entirely true that teachers pay for their own professional development. I think actually, when I was over in the Corona Norco school district, they were working out how much the unions were involved in terms of how much to pay teachers to take certain badges around competencies. So I think that actually, in a way that's different from the UK, teachers do sometimes do get paid for doing PD.
But I think there must be, because that's an illustration of it. But there's a certain amount of organized professional development that's organized by the districts in America. So a district wide kind of thing, which is a really big deal, obviously. And then if you want to go to conferences like you or I might go to, that's not subsidized. Right. That is something okay. that's.
Well, I mean, just like you and I, and my wife certainly does, is. It's sometimes it's so much of an arcane process to get reimbursed by schools, or not worth the hassle, or they just haven't got any money, that, you know, I think teachers prop up the education sector to some extent.
Yes.
Anyway. Okay, then. The only thing I was going to say on Creative Commons is I think that organization is wonderful. We're doing some work with them at the moment. Some former colleagues in Mozilla work there, in fact, including the CEO. The only critique that I've seen, which I'd be slightly sympathetic to in terms of Creative Commons, is the one from a pretty radical left, kind of copy left, almost like revolutionary communism approach, which is that making existing capitalist copyright more open precludes or prevents a space for I'm just going to give this away to the world. Yeah, it becomes less of a binary and more of a shades of grey. And so some people do critique it around that. But and on the whole, I would say Creative Commons is a hugely positive force.
But Creative Commons allows you to license something for that. You license your stuff on that
basis. I do, so that's CC0, which is technically a bit different from public domain. But I guess my point is that it almost... They don't encourage you, but the whole system seems to encourage you towards things like CC BY, CC BY NC, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my critique, I just thought I'd point to it.
No, I think it's interesting. So one of the things that's running around my mind at the moment is about regulation and the idea that when you bring regulation in, you redefine your regulation or your policies, whatever it might be, then... Everybody starts reacting to those policies until they fade out of current newsfeed, if you like, of your organization. And if you leave things to be unregulated a little bit, it just allows everyone to feel kind of relaxed in the way that they handle themselves, and that there's an element of trust which will always operate within slightly pushed out boundaries, maybe, or whatever it might be. But
there's a whole interesting thing we could dive into in terms of the tragedy of the commons here and how you make sure that those kind of trust architectures blossom, etc. Maybe that's something for a future podcast. Just being mindful of time, is there anything else we need to discuss on the kind of facets of open? I know there's lots of stuff we could go into.
There is lots of stuff, but I think we've wrapped up what we're after.
Okay. So in the miscellaneous section, we've got 5 links in here. I've tried to structure them in a way which seems logical, but feel free to whatever you think. The first one, I said there were a few posts by me in here today, is something that I wrote for DML Central while I was stuck writing the Open Education post, which was digital literacy, identity, and a domain of one's own. I don't know if you've read this. I don't expect you to have done. And what I'm trying to say is that a domain of one's own, which is the reclaim hosting thing, etc., is great, but it's a starting point, and we haven't really got to the, you know, with the open education thing and the identity, we haven't really got to a point where we're owning our own identities on the web. Maha Bali talked about, who's an Egyptian educator, talked about how even when you buy, in inverted commas, a domain name, you're effectively renting it because you never get to own it outright.
All right. Okay. Yes. Well, I was having this conversation actually. So because I went paintballing at the weekend with my boarding house, which meant that my Sunday was mostly taken up by that, and it didn't finish until 9:30 at night, and I was bruised and battered from the day. So I didn't really, my lesson planning time had gone, and that was my day off kind of thing. And, that meant my lessons Monday morning were a little bit, you know, not thought through, shall we say. And, so I walked into my lower six lesson, and it had to be a little bit from the hip. And so we talked about, so I'm into the idea of them working in the public domain. I'm into the idea of them publishing their work in that way. And we talked a little bit about their online identity and a little bit how that might work. So with my upper six class, so just using a Wikispaces thing, and they're consolidating all of their notes from the lower six, into a public space. And they're doing that as a group. So they all have a section specification allocated each. And they're just going through a process of review, and then they'll present each of the sections to each other. And in a process of that, they've shared all their notes with each other. And the person responsible for that part of the, you know, each part of the specification gets to look through. There's only, six of them in the class. So they get to look through six sets of notes and take the best of that, and then review it. And then they're reviewing each other's, and then they will present it to each other. So, you know, they have like a summary, and it's all fresh, and it's all the ideas about recapping and going, you know, reinforcing those connections in their mind about the information. So, so with the lower six, they obviously don't have that to do. They don't have any material. So I talked to them about what they might like to do. There's a similar method, and they were very keen on the idea that it would make their individual notes, that they didn't want to do it in pairs or smaller groups or whatever. And this sort of led to a conversation about, them writing online. And we looked at blogs, and, we looked at, yours, and we looked at Laura Hilliger's, looked at Amy Burville's, because they're different styles of writing and assembling information and getting your stuff out there, I thought, which were interesting. And, I said to them that what I would want for them sort of 12 months from now is to be able to write about, to write, to publish their work, and not to be apologetic about that, you know, not to get over that thing, because they're all kind of waiting. They don't want to do it. Do you know what I mean? And I said, you're going to work in the public domain in your jobs, probably in some
way. Exactly. Yeah.
And I'd like you to get used to that right here, right now. I want you to overcome that sense of not worthy, or you don't want to be honest and open about who it is that you are and what you're doing right now. Mm-hmm. So I said, we're going to get your own domain names. I said, you don't have to publish under your own real name at first if you don't want to. We can kind of stagger this in and break you into this through these barriers, these obstacles that are getting in your way psychologically, and see what it's like. And you know, you don't have to share it within your networks, but you could start building another network on the same alternative name or whatever that they choose for themselves, their alias. And sort of an interesting concept. So they're kind of... They were a little bit intrepid about it, but it was a sort of quite exciting thing, I think. And it was connected to all of this, you know, about taking some ownership. Hmm. But then one of the questions they asked was, well, how do we get a domain name? You know, how do I get this? And we looked at the process and did it, and looked at mine and how it was set up, looked at Reclaim hosting, and sort of different tools for like WordPress or whatever that they might use.
Yeah.
And then we looked at this concept. No, you have to spend $12.99 a year for the rest of your life if you want to have a thing. Well, what do you mean? If I buy my domain name, how come I haven't just bought it? And I said, well, you're paying to have your name, to have that domain name reserved for you to use as you see fit. And it's a bit like having to do that. But I couldn't really justify the idea, because you pay separately to host it somewhere on your web provider, like Reclaim Hosting. It's sort of interesting that you have to keep paying again and again and again. And I wonder where that concept came from, really. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I could talk about off the hip. I don't think I'd be well informed. I think it's to do with ICANN, which is the international body. It's supposed to be a non-profit, which looks after these kinds of things, and all of the domain registrars, so that would be Nominet in the UK, kind of sign up to this, etc. And they have overheads and costs, and they have to check things and weed out problems and everything like that. But then there's been a huge flourishing in different types of domain names. It's been a huge money spinner, actually, for some countries. So the LY one, the Libyan one,
uh-huh.
if you remember, I mean, even now there's a plethora of, you know, .ly domain names, and that was criticized because at the time Gaddafi was in power, and there's all sorts of things going on there. So effectively what you've got is hierarchy and power, and the TLD, the top level domain thing, and the DNS not really being that democratic and decentralized. And there have been some other things where they're kind of digging into some really interesting areas here. I kind of talk about this in the blog post by saying that I'd love to create an untakedownable blog, and you can kind of do it. So you could do it through Tor, so you would be given almost a random, if you try and host something on via Tor, you're given like a random scrambled .onion address, so you could do that. Problem is that it's difficult to view those, although there's some kind of conversion websites, but you're depending on those not going down. And then there's something called Namecoin, which is like DNS built on distributed things like blockchain and the stuff which underpins BitTorrent, so DHT. So I've looked into loads of interesting things here, but ultimately, either you're going to create something which hardly anyone's going to be able to access unless they're super geeky, or you're going to be subject to the authorities taking it down if they really want to.
Mm-hmm. I still think it's interesting. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but it's a bit like, if you think car registration plates, you know, you don't keep paying for your car registration plate once you've got a unique one assigned to you. And I guess the only reason would be is when something becomes defunct, it can be reused possibly, and it keeps everything a bit alive. But now that we do have a plethora of domain names, of suffixes on the end of a domain name, then it's
What you could do, and again, we're getting in the weeds here a bit, but what you could do is use dynamic DNS. So that basically does it gives you a static IP. So some connections give you a static IP anyway. You can pay for that. So you can pay extra for your internet service provider to give you the same thing, like 192.168.0.1. That wouldn't be that one, because that would be an internal network one, but something like that, something formatted like that. But if you haven't got that, if you've got a dynamic IP address, which is allocated by the ISP on demand every time you connect, depending on what device you've got, then you can get that to forward to a static IP, which people would be able to connect. So to use a homely example, underneath this desk where I'm standing, I have a server. I could forward that dynamic IP address that I get to be a static IP address, and you'd be able to access the music or the website off my server. Stephen Downs talks about this all the time, that what he sees as being the wonderful future would be if everybody hosts their website and their own stuff from their own house, rather than having massive big server farms. But who knows?
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen. Okay, interesting. Right, next.
Next is something that Amy Bavall mentioned, actually. So this is, hi Amy, she said she linked to this thing in The Atlantic, the strange way that people perceive privacy online, based on some research that was done at Montclair State University. So it says, Stanislav Mamanov, who's a business school professor, recruited more than 400 people to complete surveys that asked them a few questions about their attitudes towards online privacy and required them to secure their answers with a password. There was a control group and the main group, and it says, before answering the questions, about half of survey takers read four news stories that had something to do with government. The other half read four articles that were specifically about government surveillance. Mamonov expected that the latter group would be primed to make more complex and secure passwords because the spectre of government snooping would be on their minds. But the opposite was true. The participants that had just read about electronic spying created significantly worse passwords than the others. End of quote.
Why?
I mean, it's all speculation, really. But it seems... I mean, it goes into like an interview with him, and I haven't read it in huge amounts of detail, but he seems to think that it's to do with managing expectations about how much privacy one can actually really have anyway. And almost, well, people are going to spy on me, so it makes no difference anyway, kind of thing.
Yes, that's true. And there's also a kind of feeling, isn't it? It's that if somebody wants to, they will. Do you know what I mean? It's also that sort of that resignation, I guess.
I haven't put a link in here because it's possibly a little bit too techy, and because I only saw it mentioned on Twitter rather than a link. But apparently, you know the IMEI number, which is the unique identifier for your mobile device?
I do, yeah.
The recent IP bill, or whatever it was called in the UK, made it a specific offence to spoof the IMEI number.
Oh, really? So that must be a thing that's going on if they've done that.
Yeah.
They've got that through legislation with stolen phones, etc. Interesting. Interesting concept.
Related to that is a post which I think Amy and I were certainly talking about in Slack. I can't remember if I shared it with her or she shared it with me. But this is by Yevgeny Morozov, who writes wonderfully, but is pretty two-dimensional in his critique of Silicon Valley. This is actually from 2012. In the New York Times, but the reason I put it in is because it reminds me of an earlier day of the web. Now, a flaneur, for those who aren't aware, was somebody kind of in the 19th century, I guess, who used to walk around observing the world and, you know, just seeing the world in all its glory and making observations and kind of creative types. And I know that Amy prides herself on being a flaneur and takes these wonderful photographs of things that she's noticed when she's traveling the world. Things
she
that I would never have really seen.
I agree.
But the parallel that Yevgeny Morozov draws is a cyber flaneur. So you used to be able to go around the web and it says... it's easy to see then why cyber flannery seems such an appealing notion in the early days of the web. The idea of exploring cyberspace as virgin territory, not yet colonized by governments and corporations, was romantic. That romanticism was even reflected in the names of early browsers: Internet Explorer, Netscape Navigator, end of quote. And he talks about GeoCities and all that kind of stuff, and just keeps kind of going backwards and forwards to how Paris was at the time when people were flaneurs and how the web was, etc. And then he says how things changed, like Paris changed, cities changed, it became a bit weird just to be wandering around by yourself. And then he says what happened on the web. He said, something similar has happened to the internet. Transcending its original playful identity, it's no longer a place for strolling. It's a place for getting things done. Hardly anyone surfs the web anymore. The popularity of the app paradigm, whereby dedicated mobile and tablet applications help us accomplish what we want without ever opening the browser or visiting the rest of the internet, has made cyber flannery less likely. That so much of today's online activity revolves around shopping, for virtual presents, for virtual pets, for virtual presents for virtual pets, hasn't helped either. Strolling through Groupon isn't as much fun as strolling through an arcade, online or off. You know, that's the kind of wonderful writing he does. But basically his point is that as corporations moved in and governments moved in, quite rightly they focused on, you know, getting things done, creating apps for this particular experience, and it means that we're less likely to be in a position where we can just wander around. Something, have you used... You must have used StumbleUpon before, Di.
I have used it, yes, several times.
Well, I hadn't used it for years, and for some bizarre reason it popped into my mind, and I installed the extension.
Uh-huh.
And I just now, just every so often, just randomly click StumbleUpon, and because it's still got my profile from back in the day, It pops up with such wonderful things.
Because it remembers who you are. So I must do that. That's a really interesting. I remember having good times with StumbleUpon in the past. And it's if you're doing a sort of Pomodoro technique, you know, 5-minute breaks every half an hour or whatever, that's a perfect little antidote for one of the 5 minutes, you know, or antidote for one of the 5 minutes to take your mind away from whatever it is you've been working on before you start the next shift.
I can imagine doing this with a class and almost having a different profile for each class. And like coming up with a show of hands of whether we're going to like or dislike this particular link, because it gives you more of the same, doesn't it? Spotify playlist.
Yes, I'm part of this is sort of the whole algorithm thing as well. It's about lenses, filter bubbles, whatever, and about, you know, homogenizing choices rather than them being kind of random and or accidental, should we say, things that you stumble upon and say, okay, I'll have a little bit of that, I'll go eat there, I'll go watch that, I'll read this, and you know, so it's like if you're getting all of your books through your Kindle or indeed through Amazon Bookshop or any good online bookshop. They're going to be feeding recommendations to you based on what you've read and what you've liked or whatever. And there's
nothing wrong with that. Google Play Store this week now recommends books to you based on stuff that you read in the Google Play Store. And given that you can upload your own books into Google Play Store, that's a pretty good thing. And people say, oh, surely this can't be a good thing. Like, everyone's just going to get books that they've already read. It's going to be very narrow. Well, you know, you can always go and wander to the nearest Oxfam bookshop and pick up a book. So
it's all about purpose of self, I think. Maybe, but it is. I mean, it is a concern. But I think, like we talked about with Spotify's weekly discovery algorithm, that they're working incredibly hard because their success depends on people liking the stuff that they put through it. So they're trying really hard to make it excellent.
The thing, I suppose, about the, you know, so the example I've just given is, well, you can always go to Oxfam Bookshop and, you know, look at offline, you know, offline books. You can look at real books, like Dead Tree Books. Mm-hmm. The reason we can do that is because we've known a time before there were ebooks and a time before there was the internet. And I suppose if you've grown up with this, the mental model that you come up with is you wouldn't even consider doing that.
Yeah, like you wouldn't go and buy a CD. You know, you give a young person a CD as a present and they're like, well, I haven't got a device that this works on.
I had that problem this week, actually. I've been doing a lot more Pilates and yoga and that kind of stuff. And I bought the Ryan Giggs DVD put out 5 years ago called Giggs Fitness. Well, it's very difficult to find, and you only get on DVD. I couldn't even find it on BitTorrent. So I bought it on eBay, and I was like, crap, what am I going to do here? Like, the only place I could put it on was my PlayStation, which means it will be on the projector. Which is ridiculous. So I had to rip it using the only DVD drive I've got in my server, it's not a very fast machine, so it took like hours to rip it at good quality, and then transferred it onto my iPad. Weird.
That's true. I can't DVD either. I've got a bag, because I just moved flat over the summer, and I've got a bag of old DVDs, some of which have never been watched, and are never going to be, because I haven't got a DVD player. So that's that.
Something which I meant to talk about last week, and forgive me if we actually did and I forgot, I couldn't see in the links, were Google's new artificial intelligence voices through the Google DeepMind.
We did not talk it. Talk me through it. Sounds interesting.
Oh, it's seriously. So they've got this new thing called WaveNet. So there's a graph in this blog post I've linked to, and it talks about the difference between subjective reports of how clear a voice is. So, for example, in US English, human speech gets a subjective score of 4.55 on average. If it's a real person speaking, 4.55, I guess, out of 5. And in Mandarin Chinese, 4.21 in the control group. It then using the best kind of synthesized speech up until now, apparently there's two different methods, concatenative and...
Concatenative.
Concatenative. What I just said. And parametric. And in US English, the one that you just said, concatenative.
It says concatenated with an iv on the end.
Yes, works better than parametric. And in Mandarin Chinese, it's the other way around. But Google DeepMind has found a way. If you know when you... we were just talking about CDs there. So CDs take the smooth curve that is made by, for example, a record player when the needle goes on it and makes that smooth sound wave, etc. And a CD samples that 44,100 times every second and recreates the sound wave, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So what that's doing is effectively doing the same thing, but building the speech on the fly by doing parts of words. And it is unbelievable. The thing which really made me laugh was, I mean, there's some great... It shows you the difference between different, you know, the different voices, and it does sound better. But the fascinating thing is that it can be trained, because it's a neural network, on anything that's audio-related, which means it can compose kind of quite complicated Chopin-like pieces of music, but on the fly. So, actually, I might just play this, see if you can... I'll stick it up high and see if you can listen to this.
So that's not Chopin. That's Chopin-like.
No, it's Chopin-like, absolutely. But, I mean, that's just like they've fed in some classical music and it's just created that on the fly. And it's not, you know, you can imagine over time that would be amazing. But check out this one. So obviously it's got lots of little slices of words, which it then puts together. But it has to be trained on, obviously, how to put those together. Otherwise the neural network doesn't know what to do, and it kind of just babbles. So listen to this. It's like someone speaking in tongues. Crazy, isn't it?
It is crazy. I don't really understand it, but it's I'm intrigued.
Well, I mean, two things. If you're interested, there's a Google DeepMind blog post with all of these samples built in. So go and have a look at that. And then I try to read it, but there's a journal article by the Google DeepMind team. They've written it for a proper academic thing, and it's got big, complicated sums in. I don't really understand it, but if there's some people who might. So there we go.
Well, that was the thing. I was... I was listening to Conrad Wolfram today from the Computing at Schools conference this summer. Give his how math is taught wrongly and how computers are important talk, which was interesting. And he was doing his Wolfram Alpha into Siri, talking into Siri to do a complex quadratic equation to solve it.
I mean, this week
recognition is. I've started using it a lot more. I don't know about you, but I set loads of reminders on my phone using OK Google. Oh, look, it just activated. Please, it's a reminder to record Tide with Doug next Tuesday at 8 p.m.
Has it done it?
Okay. No, it hasn't worked.
No, right. Well, this week the Amazon Echo was launched in the UK. And did we talk about this last week? I think we might have done. But I was tempted to buy it and I didn't, and I'm quite right. But in terms of synthesizing speech, it's unbelievable. When I'm sitting there playing FIFA, I sometimes get a bit bored of the commentator saying the same thing, both in real life, when I'm watching a real football match, but definitely on FIFA. And if you can imagine, this could be able to do it on the fly.
No, I think, speech to text is getting better and better. And that's only natural, that vice versa, you know, it's going to come back the other way as well. And that this stuff is going to be used, to develop quite interesting things. And eventually, if it gets that good, it's going to be able to present voices to somebody that don't sound so synthetic and, on all of that. I mean, that's where they're really going with it. It's about sort of, if you look at the bit rate and the sample rate of the audio being converted from analog, and that's going to get more complicated because data travels faster and the processing can be done in split seconds, microseconds, milliseconds, whatever. This is going to just, and that's what they're working towards. That a thought is perfect synthesized voice eventually.
And the last link in here is a blog I've come across before. This was actually linked to from Hacker News of all places, and the I think it's a quotation from Kant. Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made. And the title of the blog post, and it's a pretty self-deprecating blog post saying that he would never write it apart from the fact that he sees other people interested in what he's doing. This guy, it's entitled Making a Classroom Discussion an Actual Discussion. And he's saying that really every time he has a discussion, I think he's talking about higher education here, but it ends up being like a game of ping pong of him almost versus 22 people. Everything goes via him.
So I love this post. This post is very pedagogical for any teachers listening. So I read this from your newsletter, Doug, and it was it's really interesting. This guy says what you just said. So you've got the ping pong. It's like, you know, you've got this round ping pong table and you're just hitting the ball to each one and they hit it back to you and then it goes, you know, and back and forth. But it's always, he couldn't stop himself sort of responding for everything and trying to break it open a little bit and tease other people into the conversation by pushing, you know, directing the conversations and the questions in different directions or and that kind of thing. But he was always involved in it. So then he goes on, it's quite a long post, but he goes on to say how he had to learn to resist the incredibly powerful pull of needing to present a neat and tidy package to them so that all issues are clearly articulated and summed up and no ends are left loose. But so instead he looks at the way to actually make it into a real discussion.
I like the way he says that he's engineered some sort of gestalt switch in his head. He said that instead of thinking that I'm depriving her by not responding, I think to myself that I'm depriving her precisely by responding, depriving her of interaction with peers or things like that.
No, I buy this completely. So this is interesting a psychological play to me, you know, psychological articulation that he's going through, just in that very simple switch that you suggested. And because it's true, it's you know, you are always... So it's quite an interesting thing in a classroom where, you know, is it a teacher with 22 or whatever separate psychological connections, or is it a room that is genuinely safe where everyone is sharing everything and you're able to traverse the social, political relationships that are going on within that class, which, you know, are going on whether you like it or not, and to be able to take it to a different sort of texture and feeling in the room. And so this to me is really quite advanced work and where education needs to be much more explored, I think, when you start looking at this sort of, you know.
The thing it made me think of is you skill. Very kindly showed me around Google Classroom this last week. So obviously I've used Google Apps, etc., but I've never had the opportunity to use Google Classroom. Pretty straightforward tool, and I appreciate you showing me how it works. What it reminded me, though, is of the implicit, pedagogy is probably the wrong word, but implicit structure of the LMS, VLE, all these kind of tools. Because really, Google Classroom almost insists that everything goes via the teacher?
Close. Yes and no. So, on your classroom, you can allow pupils to comment or to make a new post, if you like a new, they can just comment on the classroom thread. And they don't need your permission to do that, and it doesn't ask you to moderate it.
Right, okay.
It just goes in, but you can mute people. You do have control as a teacher. So there is a little bit of openness to it there. But other than that, it is pretty much
up to you. Right, that's useful pushback, thank you. But there's certainly something about how would you do this digitally, and does the digital world afford more opportunities to do the kind of things that he's talking about here, or does it like reinforce the power dynamic?
I think it's a difficult thing, isn't it? Because in my experience, you know, the sort of apps that are used for education by young people are very mainstream, and they're very much places where teachers can't get to, like Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, and that kind of thing. And I've been using WhatsApp quite a lot recently, by the way, and it's a really impressive app and so much better than Facebook Messenger. I'm trying to work out why the technologies are so different, why the apps are built so differently. Because one is of such, like the audio quality is much better when you record your voice and it's a bit odd. Anyway, but pupils use these apps in their own way, and they make connections in groups, particularly in our school, because they live here. So they make these groups, and it's across boarding houses, and you know, different populations, different year groups, or whatever. But they share their prep on it and do all that sort of thing, and they're kind of doing that. But the point is that we just don't know. Yeah. I guess, you know.
Unless there's a problem.
Say that again. Sorry, you broke up a little bit.
Oh, sorry, I was saying, like, why should you know?
No, exactly. This is the thing. I mean, you only find out about these things. Well, I talked to my pupils about it, and I tried to be open with them, and I hope they return in kind. And And there's no need to know. It's like, that's what these tools are really all about. I think it's quite interesting that, that's one of the things about Google Docs is that, you know, build a doc and anyone can come and you're not going to see it unless somebody tells you about it. And do you know what I mean?
I think there's the start of a bit of a backlash against tracking people just because you can. I think was it in New York this week? There was some kind of, I haven't got the link to hand, but something about toy manufacturers who build things with a digital element to it, tracking kids and what they do with the toys, etc. And New York, I think, explicitly banning that use of the technology with people under a certain age.
Yes. No, I've seen that. That's not so recent. I've seen that story before somewhere. Quite a big news. It was I can't remember where it was. But it is an important point, because you can do these things. Why do them? It comes back to the thing I was talking about, which is something I thought about when you were talking about Amy's post, or the post that Amy recommended, in that this, a lot of it comes down to regulation. It was the flaneuring thing, the cyber flaneur, you know.
Right.
When you start bringing regulation into things, you kind of lose that element of trust of the people involved. And obviously you reduce the abuse or possible things that go wrong. But you also, that bringing regulation in kind of hinders people's practice in some way, what they would do with it anyway. You have to be cautious about that.
Well, yeah, we could go on there. But perhaps we should tie things up there. We're at 1:26. What are you at?
If you're here, if you're listening still, well done. Get yourself a slice of cake. What am I up to this week?
Yes.
I'm this week, so it's Tuesday today. So this week I'm mostly catching up with what I'm doing this week.
You said that last week.
I know, but I had a really busy time before last week's show, and then so my Sunday was my planning time, setting my week out in front of me, and now I'm just dealing with 24 hours in advance, pretty much. I'm editing a film. I've got that to do. I'm doing some digital induction for the third form, all the new children in the school in that way. And I'm setting up possibly another digital strategy meeting for the rugby group of schools down in Radley, and other things. And I'm planning my pilot project, which is supposed to begin after the half-term holiday. So all of those things.
Cool. Well, like I said, it's Tuesday night. Tomorrow is Wednesday. I'm doing some work in the morning. Then I'm flying at 1 o'clock to Jersey. So Victoria College currently don't have someone in your position, and so need some consultancy work around that. So that involves, and they put together a nice timetable for me about discussing digital systems and infrastructure, doing some training on Google Classroom, meeting with heads of department to discuss things, planning with SLT, meeting a focus group of students, all kinds of things. And because of the flights from Newcastle, there's not one back on Friday night. I'm having to stay until Saturday afternoon. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to stay in a place which is sunnier than the northeast of England for an extra day without my family. Them's the breaks.
As long as you don't enjoy yourself, Doug,
indeed.
Yeah.
So that's me, and then I'm just, I guess, next week doing some more work with the cooperative, and what else? Writing. I'm just loving writing at the moment. And
you are being prolific. And so you keep going. Yeah. It's all good. Right. Well. So if you're still listening, thanks for listening. Doug, have a great week. I hope that all that goes well. And
we haven't got any feedback yet on the structure of this. This one is pretty much normal length, I would guess. But are people enjoying the having a main topic, or do they not really see much difference? It would be good to have some feedback.
Yeah, or really all you want to do is have a cup of tea and listen to me and Doug prattle on like we're in your front room.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the gig.
Maybe it is. And if you want to join our Slack channel, then the details are, I think on the Twitter account, I should probably put them on the website as well. And tweet us at Di Barnes, at DAJ Belshaw, or at Tide Podcast. Thank you very much for listening, everyone.
Cheerio.
I'm just going to sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.